Call the meeting to order. We do not have a quorum yet, but we're going to get started. Members, today, like most of the other days, we do have a very special individual that we'd like to recognize. And it's with the help of Mr. Bratz here, he has been able to get Harley on the phone. And so we do have the gentleman that we're recognizing today on the phone. And I visited with Poppy as well. I think everybody would be okay. We do have, like I said, Harley on the phone today. So, Harley, are you there?
Yes, good morning.
All right, good morning. Good morning. So, well, thank you for being with us today. And I'm going to, this is Representative Rod Hamilton. I'm going to get started and go ahead and read your resolution. So, here we go. It says, whereas Harley Flathers grew up on a farm in Fillmore County, his plans for farming with his father were cut short due to polio in 1949, and he spent 10 months at the Sister Kenny Polio Hospital in Minneapolis recovering and learning to walk again. And whereas Harley enrolled at the Brown Institute Radio School in 1952, his first work in radio was at KAAA in Red Wing. In 1957, he joined KROC Radio in Rochester, where he began farm broadcasts and stayed for over 20 years. For the past 35 years, he has been a sales executive for three Rochester stations and has been in broadcasting for 62 years. And whereas Harley was very involved with the Olmsted and Winona County Fairs, broadcasting from the KWEB golf cart for 13 years. He was also a regular at Country Breakfast on the farm, broadcasting, visiting with guests, and spreading the ag story. And whereas in 1996, Harley received the Rochester Agriculture Committee's Ag Person of the Year Award. In 2002, his name was added to the PAVAC Museum of Broadcasting. And he has received many other 4-H, pork, beef, and dairy awards throughout the years. Now, therefore, be it resolved by the Committee on Rules and Legislative Administration of the House of Representatives of the State of Minnesota that it thanks Harley Flathers for his many contributions to the agriculture and broadcasting communities and wishes him well in the future. It's dated February 27th, 2015, signed by the Speaker of the House, Kurt Daut, Rules and Legislative Administration Chair, Joyce Pepin, myself, and State Representative Nels Pearson. So, members, if you'd please help me congratulating Harley. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very honored. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Harley. It's so nice to be able to have you here today, even if it's via phone, and thank you for everything that you've done for agriculture. All right. Well, thank you, and we'll be sure to pass that along as well. So, Harley, we'll mail the House resolution to you so that you have a copy. And thank you once again, and you have a great day.
Thank you so much, you bet. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. Thank you. Thank you. A quorum is present, members. So, and for the members in the crowd, if you will, once again, we like to recognize someone special in agriculture all across the state and all walks of life. So I want to thank Representative Pearson. We didn't know if you were going to make it here today. And we just had a constituent years on the phone recognizing him. So, all right. So
that was Harley.
That was Harley, yes. So we're going to get started here. We're going to switch up the order of bills. I believe that Representative Bly has some individuals that traveled in. So with the weather and everything else, if you want to go ahead, we'll move yours to the front. And while he's moving up there, yes, the quorum is present. Somebody want to approve the minutes dated February 26th. Representative Johnson?
Yes, I move to approve the amendment, the minutes.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Any discussion? Representative Bly?
Yes, I believe that Representative Purcell's name has too many S's in it.
It does. Thank you, Representative Bly. So we'll go ahead and make that technical change, right, basically. All right. So we do have that. Any other discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. Representative Bly, you want to go ahead and move your bill? And
yes.
This will be held over for possible inclusion, Representative Bly.
Yes, I would like to move House File 693 for possible inclusion in the Ag Finance Bill.
Thank you. We have the bill before us. If you'd like to begin your testimony.
Thank you. This is a bill that I have carried in the past, and it's gotten bipartisan support. If you drive around the state of Minnesota and see fields that are bare or are not covered, that means that they're fragile and could the wind could carry away the soil, and we want to make sure that we protect our natural resources here in both soil and water. And the initiative of Forever Green utilizes a variety of crops and the knowledge of the importance of cover crops to these kinds of environments. And because Minnesota has a unique climate, and it's not necessarily an easy fix, so the research is important, and that's in part why I think this is such a crucial bill to carry forward and to continue to fund. So we're asking for $1,395,000 in fiscal year 2016 and in 2017, and it would be appropriated to the general fund, to the Commission of Agriculture for grants, to the Board of Regents at the University of Minnesota. And I have several University of Minnesota folks here to testify. Someone from the dean's office, as well as a professor, and some graduate students who'd like to describe some of the work that they've been able to do, and then we'll take questions.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bly. If you'd state your name for the record and begin, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Michael Schmidt, Associate Dean in the College of Food, Agriculture, and Natural Resource Sciences at the University of Minnesota. I am here on behalf of Dean Brian Boer, who is in Washington, D.C. today and sends his regrets. Today, I want to provide an update on the funding received in our college from last year's appropriation for the Forever Green Agricultural Initiative. The college thanks Land Stewardship Project and MEP for their efforts in acquiring these project funds for the university. First, let me state that this funding is very valuable to the research goals of our college, as well as the diversification of agriculture and the potential economic and environmental benefits that could be seen across the state of Minnesota. After last spring's legislative funding bill was passed and enacted for the Forever Green Ag Initiative, these are the steps that we in the college implemented. Dean Brian Boer requested the establishment of an ad hoc advisory committee with the goal of determining how to most effectively allocate the funds, as well as to establish a system for reporting and accountability. The advisory committee was composed of 10 faculty members from the college departments of agronomy and plant genetics, applied economics, food science and nutrition, horticultural sciences, and soil, water, and climate. In addition, there were also three ex officio members of the advisory committee, the Forever Green principal investigator or champion, Professor Don Weiss, who most of you know, the CFAMS Associate Dean for Research, and the college grants and research manager. An internal request for proposals was drafted and posted in late July last summer with a proposal deadline of mid-September. We established formal proposal review criteria in alignment with the legislative language. A total of 21 full proposals were received. Each proposal was reviewed by multiple committee members and scored according to the posted review criteria, and then discussed by the whole committee. The committee made a recommendation to Dean Brian Boer to fund 7 proposals. Most proposals were budgeted at approximately $150,000 for the 3-year period of time. These selected projects included such topics and crops as intermediate wheatgrass, from both an agronomic as well as a nutritional perspective, winter annual legume cover crops and how they affect soil nitrogen and carbon sequestration, perennial sunflowers, hybrid hazelnuts, field pennycress, and camelina, to name a few of the crops that the Forever Green Initiative are working on. I believe that there are or will be handouts that provide much more detail on all of these specific projects. This legislative funding is leveraging existing state and federal allocations at the university within our college, as well as other sponsored research funding from external sources. With nearly every project that was funded with this legislative funds, they are being primarily used to fund graduate students. Graduate student education is an essential and critical function that we do in our college. There are several graduate students that have started working on these projects that are here with us today and that we will hear in just a little bit. Next, though, I'd like to ask Professor Nick Jordan, a key faculty member who's been working on the Forever Green Initiative team for several years, to follow up with some words, unless there are any questions at this point in time.
No, thank you. I think we'll continue with the testimony and save the questions for the end. Thank you. Please state your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Chairman Hamilton and representatives. I'm Nick Jordan. I'm a professor in the agronomy and plant genetics department in the college that Mike helps direct. And I'd like to tell you about three things that are going on in agriculture, in our agriculture now, that I think are very exciting and that this Forever Green Initiative is really all about. So the first of these is that we're learning how to make a lot of new products for society from agriculture, beyond the food and fiber that was the traditional basis of our farm economy. There is a wide array of bio-based products, various kinds of bioenergy and biofuels, new building materials, new kinds of plastics. There's just a whole wide array of things that we are now producing from agriculture that we didn't use to before. That's the first piece of good news. The second is that the crops that allow us to produce these new things are, in many cases, new crops. And especially, they're crops that can be added to our current agriculture. So rather than displacing the corn and soybeans and wheat and other staples of Minnesota agriculture, these are things that can be added to our farms and our farm landscapes, and which grow in places and which grow at times that our traditional crops don't. So we're not in any way competing with or getting rid of our current agriculture. We're adding to it and complementing it. And then the third point is that by doing so, we're able to not only increase the basic productivity of Minnesota agriculture in a meaningful way, and I'll tell you what I mean by that with some numbers in a bit, but we're able to really move the needle on conservation of soil and wildlife and water, because by adding these new crops to our current agriculture, we're able to address a number of conservation issues very efficiently. So we have the takeaway is that we can increase both the basic productivity and conservation value of Minnesota agriculture quite a bit. And that's the horizon that's before us, and that is what the Forever Green Initiative is all about, is let's figure out how to do that. Let's figure out how to really take this opportunity. And what I'd like to do at this point is to draw your attention to one of the documents that you have as your handouts. This is the one that's called List of Selected Forever Green Projects, and dated February 22nd. And what I want to draw your attention to about this document is three things. First of all, I'd like you to see this is a big portfolio. There are a dozen different projects that address a wide variety of these new plants that we can be adding to our current agriculture to increase the productivity and increase the conservation, that value of that agriculture. So you'll see that there's a number of crops that we're domesticating, such as this so-called cup plant, Silphium, or the pennycress, and I'll have a little more to say about pennycress in a minute. And we're also trying to develop some new systems, such as ways of producing high-value biomass material from perennial crops that grow at times when annual crops don't. So I'd like you to see that this is a big portfolio. The second thing I'd like you to notice is that it involves a lot of folks. So I think there are something like 30 different University of Minnesota faculty members from a number of different colleges who are engaged, and also about 10 different bio-based products firms are involved as well. And I'd like to mention that we've managed to leverage quite a bit of funding from the initial investments that have been made in Forever Green. We have received during this past year several multi-million dollar grants, both from federal and from foundation sources. But we need more of the kind of seed funding that lets us then compete effectively for those very difficult to obtain additional grants. And the third thing I'd like to point out, and this is really crucial for Evergreen, is that if you take a look at this this list of the selected projects that are underway, what you'll notice is that each of them has essentially three parts. And this reflects the kind of three legs of the table of the Forever Green Initiative. So the first thing that we're doing with these crops is we're improving them genetically, because many of them have received vastly less genetic improvement effort than our main crops at this point, and they have some catching up to do. The second thing that we're working on, the second leg of the table, is fitting them into our current farms in a way that augments and complements our current agriculture, not displacing and competing with that current agriculture. So that is a matter of doing agricultural and agronomic research to figure out how to fit the pieces together, as it were. And then the third thing that we're working on very hard, and this is critical, is commercializing these crops. So there is no point in breeding these crops, there's no point in doing the agronomic research if it's not possible for farmers and landowners to profitably grow and market these. So we're working on the commercialization leg of the table with every bit as much effort as the other parts of it. So commercialization means developing end products that people want to buy. It means developing supply and value chains to get those products to market. And it means actively developing those markets as well. So I want to really emphasize that Forever Green is all about both increasing production, but really enabling farmers and landowners to realize new revenue from these new crops, and also very sure that we get the conservation value out of them as well. So it's a table with those three legs. The final thing I'd like to mention very briefly is just to give you some feeling for the possibilities here. I'd like to speak a little bit about this plant pennycress that we are working very hard to domesticate. So pennycress is a remarkably hardy plant. If you were to walk over and take a look at our fields at the St. Paul campus, you would see pennycress bright green, untroubled by the harsh winter that we've had, sitting there in good shape and ready to sort of pounce as soon as the weather warms up and growing conditions return. So it will start growing long before we can start planting our summer annual crops of corn and soybeans. And when you add pennycress to a corn and soybean production system by growing it over the winter time and in the early spring, we've shown that you can increase the total yield of this cropping system, or rather the soybean part, from about 60 bushels, which is what we were getting in our soybean trials last year, up to 100 bushels of oil seeds. So that's 60 from the soybean, 40 from the pennycress. So I want you to see that's a dramatic increase in the basic productivity of our agriculture. That's what we're talking about when we say we can really move the needle on production. And because the pennycress is sitting out there functioning as a cover crop, providing habitat for pollinators, covering the soil, feeding all the microbiological life of the soil that's so critical, it's doing a whole bunch of work for us. So I wanted to just briefly tell you about the potential of just one of the crops in this portfolio. So I think what I'd like to do now is to bring our students up. And Molly, would you like to get us going?
Thank you, Professor. And when you were talking, I saw a lot of ears perk up. So you're probably going to have a few questions, so don't go too far, if you would, please. So to the next testifier, if you'd please state your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Chair Hamilton. My name is Molly Kreiser, and I am a PhD student at the University of Minnesota. I'm in the Horticultural Science Department, and the forever green crop that I work on is the hybrid hazelnuts. So the hybrid hazelnuts fit into this forever green initiative as a woody perennial crop, in addition to offering all the ecosystem services that come from that continuous living cover on the land. They also can serve as things like wooded riparian buffer areas, living snow fences, or windbreaks. And during my time in graduate school, I've had a lot of opportunities to meet and talk with hazelnut growers and learn about why they are so excited about starting up a hazelnut industry in the Minnesota and the upper Midwest, and also to hear about some of the challenges that they're facing with hazelnut propagation. And one of the greatest challenges they're faced with right now is the issue of propagation and getting genetically uniform plant material. So this is the issue that my research is specifically focused on. So in our lab, we're looking at one of the sort of roadblocks to hazelnut propagation, which is the formation of new adventitious roots. And we're investigating some of the hormonal and biochemical processes that regulate this process of adventitious root initiation. And so what our goal is to really understand what are the hormonal differences between plants that form roots easily versus those that are more difficult to propagate. And what I think is really important about this Forever Green initiative is partly that it sort of gives us this opportunity to take some of that fundamental biology research that we're doing at the university and to apply it to these real-world problems and actually make a real impact on Minnesota agriculture. So I started on this project as a master's student, and I recently completed my master's degree just this January. And as I was wrapping up my master's research, I had become very passionate about this project, and I had a lot of unanswered questions that I wanted to do further research into and dig into deeper, and I also wanted to improve my skills as a scientist. So I'm very happy now that I have support and funding from Forever Green to continue to work on hazelnuts for a PhD for the next 3 years, and I hope that this terrific opportunity will give me the chance to get the skills that I need for a research career where I can continue to address questions like these, where we're looking at the plant physiology and biochemistry behind some of these real-world problems and actually make a difference in Minnesota agriculture and environment. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kreiser. And you have another testifier?
Yeah, we have two more.
All right, please state your name for the record and begin.
Okay, thank you, Chair Hamilton and representatives. My name is Gayla Altendorf. I am a second-year master's student in the Applied Plant Sciences Department, and I am advised by Don Wise and Jim Anderson. And I work on Pennycress, one of the Forever Green Initiative projects. In the first 2 years of my what will likely be a six-year stint within the Forever Green Initiative, I have come to be very familiar with its two main goals. The first goal I see is to train graduate students like myself with a unique set of skills allowing them to have what I call solution-based careers. Second, the second goal is to develop new crops for Minnesota that are efficient, diverse, economically viable, and provide much-needed environmental services. So what do I mean when I refer to a solution-based career? I'll give you a little bit, use my experience as an example. So I did my undergrad at the College of St. Benedict, St. John's University, where I earned a degree, or a Bachelor of Arts degree in Environmental Studies. Throughout my liberal arts program, I learned very well how to read, how to write, and how to speak about all the problems associated with agriculture and the environment. And what the Forever Green Initiative at the University of Minnesota has provided me is the opportunity to couple my liberal arts degree with the unique skills and experiences that I need to develop new crops through breeding to solve some of these problems. My master's project is breeding field pennycress, a winter annual cover crop that doubles as a biofuel feedstock. This means we're developing an economically viable cover crop that helps reduce soil erosion and nutrient runoff while providing a domestic source of biofuels and added income for farmers. And as a side note to just show how unique this opportunity is for me. This past fall, I went out to the Agronomy Society of America meetings in Long Beach, California, and presented a poster on my research. And I had multiple people coming up to my poster saying, like, who funds this? Like, it's so unique, and it has great potential, but it is kind of a strange crop to study if you think about all graduate students in agronomy. And I just want to add that I really don't think it would be possible for me to do this unique and very powerful research anywhere else. And I think that is one of the things that drove me to the University of Minnesota is the potential to work on some of these really diverse projects. So the Forever Green Initiative has allowed me the opportunity to move from simply describing these problems to being able to describe them and work towards a solution. So thank you, Chair Hamilton and representatives.
Thank you for your testimony. This is fascinating. We have another testifier.
Thank you, Chair Hamilton and representatives. My name is Michelle Dobratz, and I made the decision to attend the University of Minnesota because it has a global reputation as a leader in agricultural research, which is my passion. I'm sure you all remember last spring we had those devastating floods. I know you all care about our rural communities just as much as I do. And for me, going home to my rural hometown, it was really tragic to see stunted crops covered in water and to talk with farmers about the tough decisions and economic losses they faced. So we need resilient landscapes that can handle these floods and whatever else Mother Nature throws at its way. We need fields that can capture runoff, and we need systems that provide economic security and ecosystem services for Minnesota's farmers. In association with the Forever Green Initiative, I'm working on a project that remediates a lot of those issues. I'm studying a living mulch system, and for those of you that don't know, living mulch is a plant that's a companion to the landscape year-round. The clover that I work on can be planted one time, and it lasts over a decade. Then the farmers can plant into it every spring, and it protects the crops from pests such as weeds and some bugs. But most importantly, it captures runoff, and it reduces erosion year-round. These systems take a lot of time, dedication, and education to implement and to design. And actually, the education that this requires is a really unique opportunity for me. Neither of my parents graduated from a four-year university, so the fact that I've made it this far in my research career is really a dream come true for me. I would not be able to do it without funding from programs like this. By supporting this bill, you will be securing Minnesota's place as a global leader as an agricultural research school. You'll be providing new economic opportunities to revitalize rural economies. You'll be promoting ecosystem services that we depend on every day, such as healthy soil and clean water. And most importantly, you'll be honoring Minnesota's heritage as an agricultural community and conserving our resources for years to come. Thank you.
Thank you. I think while we have the three of you there, members, do you have any questions for the three testifiers? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the testifiers. You buoy my spirits, as it's nice to see youth involved with research and something that's so important. I'm particularly pleased to hear about solution-based careers and application to the to the real world, and I that just fits with my thinking. I'm curious though about the pennycress, and I just have a question. You talk about it having potential as a biofuel. Could you explain what that looks like? Thank you.
Okay.
Please.
So, pennycress its seeds have a really high oil content, and this oil can be crushed out just like you would with soybeans. It can be easily converted into a biodiesel. That answer your question?
Representative Johnson? All right. Thank you. Representative Anderson. Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions. First of all, to Molly. You talked about, in your hazelnut research, biochemistry, plant physiology. Would this be getting into GMO-type things, or how would you differentiate what you're doing with that somewhat controversial topic?
Ms. Kreiser.
Yeah. So my research actually doesn't involve any kind of genetic modification to hazelnut. What we're doing is we're looking at the chemical differences between plants that already exist because of natural variation in the different hazelnut genotypes that we already have. And by looking at these different differences between their chemistries, we're trying to understand which will be more suitable for propagation, and then we can select based on those characteristics that are already present because of the natural variation.
Chair Anderson. Thanks again, Mr. Chair. And to Kayla, you were talking about the pennycress, and the idea is excellent, but in a farming situation, if you're going to plant this crop in the fall after soybeans and especially corn come off, it's usually late in the season and dry, and the ground can be hard. How do you address the problem of getting a stand established in those type of conditions?
Ms. Altergaard? Did I get that name right?
Close. Altendorf. Yes.
Alterdorf.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Thank you, Representative Anderson. Okay, so I actually work on the breeding aspect of pennycress. So we have a whole team working on this project, and we have actually two different graduate students working on more of the agronomics and working on establishment. But we're looking into developing pennycress as a relay system. So relay meaning that there's overlap between the two crops. So for example, in the fall, you could overseed pennycress into standing corn to give it extra time to establish before it gets too cold or too late. So we're testing out multiple different planting techniques to try and figure out a way to resolve that problem. But good question. I hope that answers it.
Thank you. Representative Anderson?
Yeah, just one more, Mr. Chair. Thanks. And one of you talked about the advantages. I think either corn or soybeans, a real big boost in yield. Could you explain how that happens and why that happens?
We'd like to field that question. Oh, we wanted to hear from the students.
Yeah. I can tell you, it's not my research, but I can explain to you why cover crops boost yields.
Yes, please.
So, for example, I work on leguminous cover crops, and so what they do is they pull nitrogen out of the air and put it into the soil. And as I'm sure you're all aware, nitrogen is a really expensive input for farmers. So that's one way you can boost yields, is by adding nitrogen to the soil. Another way you can boost yields is by making the soil healthier and more fertile. And that can be established in a number of different ways. So by adding organic material.
Could I add to that?
Yes, please.
Okay. So what Nick was referring to is an increase in overall system yields. So by just planting soybeans, you can yield a certain amount. But by planting pennycress and soybeans, overall, even though you might see a little bit of a yield loss by, you know, maybe planting your soybeans a little bit later in the spring or a little bit of competition or something like that, overall, your total income and total system yields are higher when you have both the crops on the landscape.
Chair Anderson.
Okay, just one follow-up. So you're assuming then that there's going to be a profitable market then for the cover crop, correct?
Exactly. For pennycress specifically, like I was explaining before, the oil can be easily converted as a drop-in fuel, meaning that there's little to no infrastructure needed to use this fuel. So it's been actually converted to jet fuel before. And there's, if you Google pennycress later today on your lunch break or whatever, you'll see that there are actually industries developed in Illinois surrounding pennycress, and it's actually happening right now. So.
Thank you. That's exactly what we're all going to be doing over lunch. So, thank you. Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much for the testimony. It's very enlightening and very, as Representative Johnson said, it's very exciting to see young people getting engaged in this. I just had some question about the actual process. So, Forever Green funds these different projects. What does that mean monetarily to you? Are you funded? Does it reduce your tuition? Is it just a little bit more about that?
Who would like to take that one?
Okay, so we are fully funded graduate students, meaning that we can come in to the program and the money that a grant provides covers our tuition, covers a living stipend for us, and then covers our research costs. So most, if not all, of the other graduate students in our department are funded on grants that provide them, you know, enough money to live on as well as pay for the tuition.
President Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then a follow-up. So if you did not have access to this fund, the Forever Green, how would that have altered your trajectory here and being a graduate student?
Ms. Altidore. Or anybody.
Well, sure. So I'm actually, my master's degree was funded by the Variety Development Fund through the University of Minnesota. So maybe these two who are actually funded by Forever Green currently might want to attest to that.
I think, personally, I think it might be very difficult to find funding for these kinds of projects elsewhere. Sometimes it can be done, but it's very helpful to have these funds that are specifically for Forever Green projects, since they are relatively new and different.
Person Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I anticipated that would be the answer, so thank you very much. I think it's, again, a very worthwhile effort, and Representative Bly has been a champion for Forever Green in the last biennium and continuing on today, so I very much appreciate your perspective, the work that you're doing, and hopefully in a few short years we'll be able to see pennycress on a lot of fields, maybe, and some hazelnut crop around the and other perennials. So thank you for the work you're doing.
Thank you to the testifiers. Greatly appreciate it. I'm going to ask every one of you, do you believe in your research? Do you think this is a viable solution for agriculture? It's a question for all three of you.
Indeed, yes, no doubt. And I am just incredibly grateful to be a part of something that I am passionate about, and not just learn breeding through some traditional way, but in a way that I think has potential.
Thank you.
Yeah, I also agree. It's very exciting, and feel very passionate about it and believe in what we're doing, and it's really very exciting to be working on something that is new like this.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Hamilton. I also agree that not only is it an incredible opportunity to have the work that I have, but it's an incredible opportunity to be able to do it here in Minnesota.
Thank you. We do have another question. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I want to apologize to the committee and myself. I had to step out for a constituent, so I don't know if anybody asked this question, but I'm just wondering, and I did hear Professor Jordan's testimony, I'm just wondering if any of the work you're doing is applicable or can work in the urban farming environment, if any of you are looking at that or interested in that yet, or if it's something that you're familiar with.
Who would like to take that question?
Thank you, Chair Hamilton and Representative Clark. I am not doing research in urban systems, but I do also do some professional service on urban agriculture initiatives. So that's not what my research is on, but I can see how my methodology would be applicable in an urban setting. Problem is, a lot of people don't like clover or urban agriculture in the city. So I think there's a big cultural resistance in some communities, but that's something that we're working on here in Minneapolis and St. Paul. You see a lot of people are changing their attitudes about how to use green space. So that's not something that my research focuses on, but I think a number of these applications could be used as the urban agriculture movement takes off in these cities.
Yes, and Representative Clark is a champion on that, and we're going to help her to change the perception of urban agriculture. Right, Representative Clark?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's it. I'm just imagining some of these plants growing on some of the vacant properties that we have. I mean, it would be fabulous. So, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Clark. Thank you to the testifiers. I'm sorry, Chair Anderson.
Thanks again. Please indulge me for one more question, Mr. Chair.
Of course.
I think it was Kayla, Ms. Altendorf. You mentioned that you had hoped or you thought your research would go on. I think you mentioned 6 years, something like that. And I have to ask, you know, we like to see results and things happen and progress made. And that seems like kind of a long time. And we have pennycress today. And do you see it taking that long to have it become commercially viable, or what do you see down the road that it would take so long to make this a viable crop?
Okay. So when I said that, I meant that within my educational time at the U of M, like, so I started 2 years ago, I'll finish my master's in a year, and then I will be doing a PhD for 3 more years. So that's what I meant by the 6 years. So for my master's with pennycress, we are with this next field season, we'll be doing seed increases for yield trials. So, yes, breeding takes time and development takes time, but I would argue that it's, like, tremendously faster than it was even 10 years ago with the technology that we have. So I guess we're hoping in hopefully 2 years to have something that's being tested on a larger scale in Minnesota.
Chair Anderson, follow-up?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. You talk about the technology. So what technology has advanced? One of you said you're not using any GMO-type things, but so talk about the technology you're okay. using that's better today than 10 years ago.
Okay.
Ms. Altendorf.
So today we can use DNA sequencing. So let's just clarify. A GMO is when you take one gene from another species and insert it into an unrelated species. So with Pennycress, we're not doing anything related to that. We're using traditional breeding. But the difference between now and 10 years ago is that the cost of DNA sequencing has dropped like 100-fold. So we have the Pennycress genome sequence, which basically means that we have like a book of a Pennycress like instruction manual as sort of as a metaphor that you can open up to different chapters and figure out like what controls this and what controls this. And we know all of this because we have sequenced the genome. So what's faster today is that we can select and we know specific things within the genome that we can look at the DNA of a plant and confirm that it has certain traits without even having to grow the plant out. Does that help answer your question? So to clarify, we're not using GMOs. We're using like advanced modern breeding technology that is not GMO.
Chair Anderson, just shake your head yes. Yes. So, well, thank you to the testifiers. It's always exciting. I don't know who said it. I think it was Representative Poppy. It's always exciting when you have just the students or anybody that is younger than us that come in here and they're passionate about agriculture. We truly, truly appreciate that. Thank you for all that you do. So, Representative Bly, do you have some other testifiers? All right. Thank you.
I had hoped that Chair Hamilton, I had hoped that Carmen Fernholz would be able to make it to testify, but the weather slowed him up and he wasn't able to get here. So Bobby King will talk a little bit about what he might have said.
Thank you. Mr. King, please state your name, who you represent for the record, and begin, please.
Bobby King with the Land Stewardship Project. Thank you, Chair Hamilton.
Welcome.
I actually can't talk about what Carmen Fernholz was going to talk about. If the roads were passable, he'd be here. He's been doing promotion and research on cover crops and perennial crops on his farm for decades, and he sees a real potential to dramatically increase the use of cover crops now and partly because of work like Forever Green. But I just wanted to say that Land Stewardship Project sees this as a critical public investment in producing a public good, which is what our land-grant university is all about at its best. And we know now, I think it's indisputable, that we have to have more cover crops and perennial crops on the land to address water quality issues. And farmers need more tools to do this. And they need tools that work in the field, and they need tools that work for the bottom line. And that's exactly what Forever Green is about. And we see this really as a moderate investment, $1.4 million a year, to address what is really a statewide concern. And the last thing I want to say about it is the importance of this investment is going to be that it is ongoing, because we're researching living systems and we're researching developing markets. And both of those things need time and change over time. So we greatly appreciate the past support Forever Green's gotten and hope we could see that it's funded again this session. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. King. And we fully understand with the weather and whatnot, so please tell your testifier, Mr. Fernholz, just be careful.
Tell him to turn around. He's probably trying to get up here.
There you go. Perfect, perfect. Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union, and we, too, have been long supporters of Forever Green and the initiative. And I think you've heard a lot about it, but I always say there's a lot of interest in our members in cover crops. And I think a lot of people are starting to see all the different you know, when it affects a farmer's bottom line, and they can see it improving soil health, they can see it, you know, helping water quality, holding the nutrients. People are interested in trying to figure out how to do it. A lot of our farmers talk about a lot of just the mechanics of it. How do you seed in a cover crop into corn? Do you use the high boys? Do you, we have farmers that are flying in, you know, flying over and dropping seed, the robots, all these different things are very interested. And I think that this bill helps get us to that. One other point I wanted to make, it's funny that we've been talking about Pennycress a lot today because I've worked on that. For many years, Farmers Union, we had, it's been a few years now, but we partnered with a biodiesel plant here in Minnesota who wanted to grow Pennycress, and they wanted farmers to grow it. And so we held two meetings, and we had like 50 farmers show up that were interested in planting Pennycress, and some of them did. And this has been a couple of years, and I've talked to the professors about it, but they had some issues with it, the ones that did. And so I think the interest is there within the industry to look at it as another oil crop where it makes sense. And then but they had problems. I know the I think the seed is small, and the screen and harvesting was a problem, and the planting and just getting the seeds was a problem. And so there's a lot of issues, and I think that there is a tremendous issue for it, and I appreciate your consideration for the bill. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. I believe we have another testifier. And for the two, don't run off too far in case we have some questions. Please state your name and who you represent and begin, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I do have a handout here if I could share that with the committee.
Get the page to help us out.
And I know the hearing has gone long, so I'll be very brief. Steve Morse, Executive Director of the Minnesota Environmental Partnership. So we are the state's largest coalition of environmental conservation groups, and we've been involved in supporting this initiative for a number of years. And I just want to make three points. Number one, as you can tell, this is a very different type of approach to water quality and habitat. It's not a regulatory approach. We talk a lot about water quality issues. We talk a lot about habitat. But we're really excited about this because it is non-regulatory. It, as you've heard in the testimony, it's really a systems approach that can satisfy the productivity side, the profitability side, the habitat side, and the water quality side all at the same time. And that's why we call it, as you'll see in the handout, smart crops, because we really think it's the next generation of thinking about agricultural systems that can incorporate more of these benefits. It's also a little bit of back to the future, because it's not unlike what we did years ago when I was growing up in southeastern Minnesota. Secondly, it really builds on our resources at the university. It's supporting the university as an international leader on these issues and leveraging other funds. So we think it's very critical the state put in some seed money, which this bill is, to leverage other funds. And lastly, what you saw here with the graduate students was a living testament to not only the project, but to the need for consistent, ongoing support. And that's really key to this, and that's why we're back here year after year. This is, I think, the third year we've been on this. It's because we've gotten some pots of money. But what we really need is some consistent long-term money, because these are natural systems that will take years to develop, so we can develop the expertise and the program in order to make this pay off in the long term. But we're very excited about the benefits this can provide for our state, for agriculture, and for our natural resources, and we encourage your wholehearted support. And thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions, members, for the testifiers or Representative Poppy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, I have a question for Professor Jordan.
Professor Jordan.
Thank you, Chair and Representative Poppy.
You had talked about how this is the ability to make new products, especially with regards to bio-based and biofuels, and add new crops. I'm just wondering about an old crop, and that would be corn and corn stover. And I know that there's a need to kind of keep the land able to replenish itself and to have the perennial crops and be able to continue to grow and provide nutrients and all of that. But I'm wondering a little bit about corn stover. We've got some initiatives to talk about bio-based production, and I'm just wondering about the ability to remove corn stover with continuing to leave intact enough to be able to provide for that nutrient base. And if you could just comment on that, weigh in on that, please.
Thank you, Mr. Jordan. Representative Poppy and Chair.
My opinion as an agronomist is that it is possible to remove substantial amounts of corn stover from corn and soybean cropping systems. It's necessary to, I think there's a research base that shows clearly that what is required is the use of perennial grasses in places where we need to control the flow of water and soil upon removal of stover. I think the research base also shows that in many soils it's necessary to use cover crops afterwards. What is exciting to me is that I hear many, many farmers saying, look, the new hybrids are producing really large quantities of corn residue, corn stover. We need to get that off our fields in cold climates. We really like the idea that we pull that off the fields, we get some the profit figures of $30-$40 a ton seem to be real. We really like that we get that kind of revenue. That might be another $100 per acre. We really like that that revenue lets us get our cover crops out on the landscape, finances that. We really like that whole package. So that would be my opinion as an agronomist regarding that the corn stover situation. I think it's an important opportunity.
Representative Poppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just an additional comment. I would agree. I think that it is a potential for us, and I'm excited to think that we may be moving along on a production incentive for the biomass and to use corn stover as part of that, along with perhaps some of these potential developments that we have with these fine young people.
Thank you, Representative Poppe.
Mr. Chair, could I respond?
Professor, please.
I'd just like to add that the future is to use the stover and the other sources of biomass and use those together to get to what we might call a critical mass on this new industry of value-added biomass, making high-value products for things like corn stover.
Thank you, Professor Jordan. Some Poppy? Representative Anderson, we're going to spend about 7 more minutes on this. Okay, Representative Bly? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Also a question for Professor Jordan. You mentioned that the 21 proposals received, you funded 7. And I would assume because of the outstanding graduate students we have heard today and are back at school, this work is being done on your St. Paul campus. But I would encourage you to, because of our state's varying soils and climates, to look at some of the outreach and research stations around the state and to get some of these projects spread around the state to take advantage and look at the different, again, climates and soils around the state.
Professor Jordan?
Chairman Hamilton and Representative Anderson, thank you for that question. We are certainly doing so. I wanted to mention that we have some production trials up at Crookston for this intermediate wheatgrass, which is this new perennial wheat-like grain crop. And in fact, we're starting to grow it on a small but commercial scale up there as part of those trials. But your point is very well taken.
Follow up? No. Representative Johnson, looks like you have the last question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think I might have 2 questions. But I want to pick up on Professor Jordan on your comment about where the future is really a combination of the stover and some other crops, perennials. How far are we from that being viable, that combination that you're talking about?
Professor Jordan.
Thank you, Chairman Representative Johnson. We're close. There are 4 different technologies that all do the same thing, which is that they grind up this kind of biomass, they treat it with some sort of chemical alkaline material, and by doing so, they make it much more valuable for livestock feed purposes or for any sort of biorefining that involves microbial fermentation. One of these technologies, which is the ADM second crop technologies, is available right now. And what these allow us to do is something we have never been able to do before, which is to make high-value products from these cellulosic biomaterials. this is different from cellulosic ethanol, which is getting off the ground now, but rather slowly. This is a different technology that makes a kind of a biomass commodity that can go right into animal agriculture markets or into biorefining markets. And as I mentioned, the ADM technology is commercially available right now. The company Rotochopper in Minnesota is working very hard on that technology. We work very closely with some folks at Michigan State University who have another technology that we think is the best. So that is not too far over the horizon, and that will be a very important development for us, because then farmers can really make decent profits from these biomass materials. We've never had that opportunity before.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then what I think may be an easy question, I'm assuming then that these funds can help promote that, speeding up that timetable.
That's
absolutely how we are using it.
Thank you. Representative Bly, you want some closing statements before we hold your bill over?
It would be difficult to add anything meaningful to what you've already heard. So thank you for your indulgence, Chair Hamilton, in allowing us to go first to help out our testifiers. And really welcome support for this initiative. I think it's really a great thing for Minnesota and for the university as well.
I tell you what, Representative Bly, I think I'm going to have you line up my testifiers from now on. You hit it out of the park. They're fantastic. So thank you. Members, House File 693 will be held over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Bly. All right, do we have Representative Considine? Representative Sundin, do you want to move the bill, get it for us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I'd like to move House File 772 for possible inclusion.
Thank you. Representative Sundin moves House File 772. It's before us. This bill will be held over for possible inclusion. Representative, welcome.
So well, thank you.
Please begin. I see that you have some testifiers.
I do, and I've also bowed to the tradition, I guess, of the first bill. I brought you treats.
Wonderful, wonderful.
The bill's, I believe, pretty straightforward. I believe there's an opportunity for what I consider to be the best farmers, family farmers in the world here in Minnesota, to expand the markets in Cuba as the restrictions are being lifted, and I would like to see us get down there first and again expand the markets. 2002 report talked about a difference of basically three times what we're currently doing. At that time they were looking at 17 million and a possibility of going up to 45 million. Currently we're at 20 million, so if you extrapolate that out, it would be about $60 million in markets for Minnesota farmers. In recent news articles, Cargill, Farm Bureau, National Farmers Union have all expressed a desire to move forward with this. The National Farmers Union is here, and they would be happy to come down and take some questions. But actually, the only testifier I have right now is somebody who's actually been there and has been has experience in the Cuban markets, Mr. Kaler.
Well, thank you, Representative. And these aren't your treats, aren't Cuban cigars, are they?
No, they're not.
All right, I saw your testifier, so I got a little nervous, Mr. Kaler. Please state your name and welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Ralph Kaler from St. Charles, Minnesota. Appreciate the privilege of being here. We just wanted to follow along having young testifiers in, as you mentioned earlier, Representative Hamilton.
So that's the gentleman sitting next to you, right?
Yeah, unfortunately. First wanted to say thank you again, but your recognition of Harley Flathers is well deserved. He's been a fixture in southeast Minnesota for decades. That's he's been promoting agriculture forever and ever, so that was well deserved for him. We're here, obviously, to ask for your support on the House File 772. As multi-generation farmer who owns a century-owned farm, my son Cliff is here. He'll be the fifth generation on our farm. They've been to Cuba. My youngest son, Seth, and his fiance, who both graduated from South Dakota State in May. We're also going to be here to testify, but the weather didn't quite cooperate with them, so I do have Shelby's statement I'd like to read in. I don't know, doing it now or after I talk. Maybe I'll just...
Please, go ahead.
And her and Seth will be taking over kind of the cattle portion of our business. With farmers, we like to bring the next generation on. I wasn't smart enough to buy land 20 years ago, but we got involved with some trade and other things. So my version of bringing the kids back in, of Cliff came back from out east and started a solar company, and Seth will be taking over the cattle, and that way they're responsible for my retirement. That makes it a lot easier on me as I get a little older. But Shelby's line is... trying to read it here. Everything's gotten better with technology except printers and stuff, I think. Now, I'm Shelby Radke from Minnesota Lake, Minnesota. My family raises beef breeding stock and co-owns a butcher shop in Easton, Minnesota. Would have been her first time testifying, and she's here with her fiance's family. Seth and her and I plan to continue the Kaler's efforts to export Minnesota ag products to Cuba and other countries as part of our plan to stay involved in Minnesota agriculture. She's here to testify in support of House File 772. My fiance's family has been involved in promoting trade to Cuba since 2002. As Seth and I begin our career in agriculture, the funding from this bill will provide the necessary support for us to continue his family's efforts to promote peace and increase Minnesota trade. As a young couple in a small family-owned business, this extra support will help offset overhead costs necessary to keep our business viable in Cuba. We do not have a separate export division or the available budget that large established corporations can self-fund. We hope you support this bill to assist a rural Minnesota family business improve its odds of surviving a transition to the next generation. Thank you for this opportunity.
Very nice. Thank you, Mr. Kaler. So you you have your son with you as well?
Yes, and I'll let him take over the... No, you can talk. I think you can cover most everything we need.
Thank you for inviting us, and as my dad mentioned, we're here in support of House File 772. So, you know, you look at our three closest neighbors, you got Canada, Mexico, and Cuba. Two of them are huge trading partners of ours, and a third we can hardly trade with. So I don't think it takes a lot of logic to realize that Cuba is a completely untapped market. When we've been down there, it's been as though they've been frozen since the 1960s when we put the embargo on. So imagine an economy that hasn't really progressed since the 60s, and it's soon to be open for trade. So in my mind, there is no question as to whether or not Cuba is a big market or whether or not America is going to capitalize on it. We're going to capitalize. The embargo is going to fall. I don't think that's any question. The question in my mind is, how is Minnesota going to compete with the other states, and are we going to be the state that capitalizes on this huge market? You know, there's two markets and industries that I know, and that's agriculture and energy. You know, when you're down there with Cuba with solar energy, a lot of the farms there have solar panels because they have a weak grid, and they're an island nation, so their cost of electricity is high. So that's a huge market for some of our made-in-Minnesota solar panels. And then you look at agriculture. They need help. Because of the embargo, it's stifled some of their innovations. So they're going to import a massive amount because, you know, for us, we look at increasing production so that we can get more pounds of beef, more pounds of pork. When we were down there, they looked at increasing milk production so they could send more milk to their kids and less onto the farm, which is a completely different way of looking at it from how we do it. And last time we were there, they got their butter from New Zealand. So, you know, I'm pretty confident of our ability to compete with the lower transportation costs. So going back to what I said originally, it's not in my mind a question of if Cuba's a big market, it's how are we going to capitalize. And I see two ways that we can capitalize. You know, the first is we just have to have better businesses and more competitive products than our competitors. That is the most sustainable, long-term approach to having business in Cuba or anywhere. That being said, I don't think any bill or any short-term fix is going to change it. We already either are or aren't competitive. I believe that we are as a state. And so, you know, we're competitive there. Now, the second way that we can compete is getting the first mover advantage. And the benefits that that will bring is it can strengthen our strengths, and it's going to hide some of our weaknesses. With the first mover advantage, people would learn the market. And again, completely new market, completely different economy, economic system. And so if people are going to move there and go there and do business, they need to understand what Cuba's like. It's very different than here. That's not a bad thing in terms of opportunity for business. It's just different. The second is the connections. For our family, we need to go down there and reestablish some of our connections. That's incredibly important in any market or any business, but especially a foreign country that's completely new. And the third is by being the first mover, we're going to de-risk it for Minnesota businesses. Every hour and dollar we spend in Cuba, we have to justify internally as an hour or dollar that's spent, that's taken away from some other opportunity anywhere else. And so the second time you've been to Cuba, the second sale you've done, it's really easy to justify more investment, spending more hours down there, sending more people. But it's that first one that we need the push to get people to go down there. And so now drilling it down kind of into how it could help us and our companies, we're small companies. We're growing very fast, and it's been going well, but we're still small. We don't have the time, resources, or capital to simply put someone full-time on Cuba and say, well, if it works out, great. If it doesn't, you know, we'll roll with it. You know, for our company, we need that assistance to go down there, and there's a ton of other small companies in our position that have this huge opportunity in front of us but can't afford to take that risk right off the bat without some assistance. And it's not necessarily just financial. And so, yeah, you know, when I look at this, I think of it as almost, you know, this bill is almost R&D. You know, if I look at it, if you're a company, it's basically Minnesota spending R&D to develop new markets. And the big benefit is it's going to be supporting exports, so it's going to be an infusion of cash into the state on top of jobs and profitability, which can then further be reinvested. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Kaler, I'm going to refer to you as Cliff with two Mr. Kalers up there, if that's okay. So, yeah. Cliff, you traveled to Cuba. How old were you when you first went over there?
Sixth or seventh or eighth grade, something like that.
Yeah,
so 15 years old.
Well, I saw the pictures, and I think it. Ralph is a friend of mine, and that's where the jokes and some of the heckling comes in. So I'll say, Cliff, I'm so grateful that you received the intelligence from your mother. So I will say that.
I am too.
All right.
Why does everybody say that?
Yes, because we know you, Mr. Kaler. So I'm just kidding. That was great testimony. Any questions for the testifiers, members? Any questions? So, well, thank you. And you've been there, Cliff. You've been to Cuba how many times?
I don't actually know. It's been a lot.
A lot. Many, many times. And so you've seen the opportunity firsthand. We've heard that in your testimony, correct?
Yes. It's unlike any country I've been to. You know, there's pros and cons to it. But it's just, you know, it's a country that's been frozen in time since the 60s. And so the opportunities there are just endless. I mean, in any industry I've been involved and you go down there, there's just so much opportunity. And the other thing is the workforce is educated and they work hard, so it's not as though you're going to a place that has no skilled workforce. They just don't have the resources to capitalize on their opportunities there. And I think it was what, half the land's fallow in Cuba or something like
correct.
That
the opportunity to improve production is huge because of the lack of resources. There is huge growth potential. And as a Minnesota farmer right now, we have an advantage with Minnesota being on the Mississippi. Normally when we export to Asia or a lot of the other countries, we got to go to the coast, so we lose some of our advantages. With Cuba, we pick up an advantage that they're buying the products we produce, and we export half of all our ag production in the state as a general rule. We can get it down the Mississippi very efficiently and to Cuba, so we have an advantage over some of the other states that we normally lose. And now as things change, we'll be able to bring products back also, so making our ag products all that more competitive than they are now.
Thank you. Representative Clark?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it's been about more than 15 years since I had a chance to go to Cuba, and it was all through a people-to-people opportunity and got to visit a little bit of the farming community there and was impressed with that. Mr. Chair, my question is to you. So when are we as a committee going to take a trip to Cuba?
That's a great question. Well, I'm informed that we don't have a big enough budget for that, unless they can put us on a barge and ship us there, maybe. I don't know. But that would be a fun trip, wouldn't it? Mm. We'll look into that. We'll make that request to the speakers. So.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Any other questions for the testifiers? So, Chair Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative, Minnesota already does some promoting of our export markets to a certain extent. What would your bill do to enhance that? It's not a real large sum of money, but what would your bill do to help further that push down there?
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a changing landscape down there. And with the changes in the administration's embargo, it's going to make it a lot more open. And the first 50,000 would actually be mostly for a trade mission to go down there to develop the contacts, find out what the regulations are, and then and how they're going to be improved and changed. For example, right now, if a farmer wants to export to Cuba, they have to have the money up front. They have to have it in a third-party bank in a different country. I believe all those things would be changing. So we need to find out what the new rules are and regulations. And the second part of the bill, the other 50,000, is to come back then and explain it to family farmers and producers how they can, you know, take advantage of the opportunity.
Representative Anderson. No? Any other questions? Any last words? Representative Considine, any last words?
I think it's a tremendous opportunity for Minnesota farmers. Again, referring back to that 2002 study that I read, they were talking about in 2002, I believe it was 901 new jobs in greater Minnesota. And like I say, they were looking at that time, 45 million, but again, as the things have increased, and if you extrapolate it out, I don't think 60 million is an unrealistic figure. So, yeah, it seems to be win-win for everybody if we get down there first.
All right, I think your testifier.
Comment. I think actually, as I came in today, when we look at the three bills that the committee's talking about, I'm pretty excited about what it looks like for agriculture. I guess it hit me as I was sitting there. A lot of times in farming and ag, we're complaining or looking at the downside of things. But if you look at our three bills today for where it puts Minnesota as a leader and looking at our transition, we got, you know, the funding, the cover crops, Cuba, and our vet diagnostic labs. All three of those things are putting us as a farmer and our state, it's putting us out in front. And I guess personally, I'm pretty excited about being here and seeing what we're doing. And sometimes we miss that. But I think that's it says a lot about our state and its approach towards agriculture and the people we have involved in the business. So that's my last 2 cents worth.
Thank you, Mr. Kaler. I'm going to keep you around to do my opening statement on the next bill. So all kidding aside, Ralph, you should be very, very proud. I'm stating the obvious. Cliff, you did a fantastic job. Thank you for coming here today and offering up your testimony. It's greatly appreciated, and thank you for being leaders in agriculture. And I greatly appreciate the friendship. Say hello to your mother, if you would, please, Cliff.
All right. Thank you.
So Representative Sundin renews his motion for House File 772 to be laid over for possible inclusion. So thank you. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Sundin. Or Representative Considine, thank you. All right. Yep.
Members, our last bill of the day is Chair Hamilton's bill. And we'll wait for him to be seated, but I really appreciate him leaving his donut with me. I'm just kidding. I'll leave it here. I won't leave it. Pardon? Oh, yeah, he did. Yeah.
So.
Okay, Mr. Chair, would you like to...
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll move that House File 941 be held over for possible inclusion. And members to the bill, you know, all kidding aside, I really appreciated the comments from Mr. Kaler, and he was spot on. He was absolutely right. Minnesota has been, and we want to continue to be leaders in agriculture, in various agriculture initiatives. And how this bill came about, I was in a meeting with members from the University of Minnesota, and I'll let them speak to the bill, obviously, and the position of the university on this bill. But my comment was, I shared with them a story about the individual that I've been affiliated with for over 20 years. And prior to his passing, now we're in the pork industry, prior to his passing, he was quoted saying in a newspaper that the biggest threat, in his opinion, the biggest threat to agriculture is emerging diseases. And we want to make sure that we have everything in place to protect all of agriculture from emerging diseases. And to that point, then, I asked the question to some university representatives. I said, what would we need if myself or anybody from the committee or anybody in agriculture would walk across the St. Paul campus and visit the facilities? Would we see state-of-the-art equipment? Would we be impressed? Would we be recognize the fact that we are truly leaders in this, in agriculture, in research, and et cetera, et cetera? And if not, and this does not knock any of the individuals that we have, because we have fantastic people in place. I asked, what would be some of the things that we could invest in to address whether they're concerns or to elevate us to that next level? And these were some of the ideas that were brought forward. And so I wanted them to then come in and testify, and they can speak to some of these ideas as well, and then get the committee's perspective and go from there. So, Madam Chair, I know we're short on time, if you will, so if I could just have the testifiers introduce themselves and speak to the bill.
Go ahead.
Hi, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Trevor Ames, the Dean of the College of Veterinary Medicine.
I'm Jim Collins, Director of the Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory at the University of Minnesota.
Thank you. And who would like to start first?
Madam Chair, I'll go first. Thank you. So I'm certainly thrilled to have this opportunity to address the committee and talk about this important need for the Veterinary Diagnostic Lab. I did provide you with a PowerPoint presentation, and so we can maybe follow through the presentation, but it won't be showing on the screens. So obviously, in the second slide, I just highlight, I think, what everyone at this committee knows and accepts, that agriculture and the livestock.
Do we know why he was making that?
Well, if you can run and grab IT, that'd be great.
Yes,
all right,
please.
Thank you. All right.
Sorry about that.
But we do take our role as part of the land-grant university very seriously, and we think it's our job as the veterinary college, through the work of our graduates, the work that we do in research, and the work that we do through our service organizations like the Veterinary Diagnostic Lab, to keep the animals in the state healthy. By doing that, we think we keep the economy healthy, and certainly we also strive to keep the citizens of the state healthy. And the third slide actually just talks about how veterinary college can keep the citizens of the state healthy. And obviously, if we're going to have healthy animals, then we'll have a safe food supply. But we're also involved in research, biomedical research, research on diseases that can go back and forth between animals and people, And so through that, we have an impact on human health. And then finally, with the growing importance of pets in our lives, and also the way Minnesota values the natural resources, I think we all agree that animals play an important role in keeping our psychological and physical well-being. I can talk loud if we can turn this off.
Yeah, we need to record it, though.
They're around to get IT. So I'd like to spend a couple of minutes highlighting the Veterinary Diagnostic Lab. It plays a very important role in ensuring the health of the animals in the state. As Dr. Collins, the director of the Diagnostic Lab, will tell you, it's the only animal health lab in the state that will drop everything if there is an emerging disease threat. And that's very important, and our diagnostic lab takes that very seriously. It's also the only accredited lab in the state that is accredited to do testing that allows animals and animal products to be made for export purposes to go to countries like Cuba. So on the next slide, it talks a little bit about some of the specific things that the diagnostic lab does in terms of disease surveillance, and we conduct disease surveillance on all animals, species within the state, from our livestock to wildlife, etc. But also the diagnostic lab does day-to-day testing that supports day-to-day management decisions for our livestock producers. So just as an example, if a group of animals needs to be moved from one farm site to the other and the livestock producer wants to know if it's safe to move those animals, if they get the test samples to our diagnostic lab by noon, by 7 o'clock that night, validated test results will be available online that producer can access and use to make a management decision. Our lab is also involved in developing new tests as new diseases emerge. We obviously train veterinarians and veterinary students. In fact, pathology is one of the things that every accredited veterinary school must train every veterinary student in. We train advanced training, so we train the veterinary pathologists, the people that work in diagnostic labs, and we're also involved in research discoveries that come out of the diagnostic lab. The sixth slide shows you how the diagnostic lab relates to the state and the state agencies. So the diagnostic lab is the official lab of the Board of Health, but it is located within the University of Minnesota. So Dr. Collins has the unique pleasure of reporting to both me as the dean of the college and also reporting to Dr. Bill Hartman, the state veterinarian. I want to point out that in addition to that, the Wilmer Poultry Testing Lab, the Minnesota Poultry Testing Lab in Wilmer, is part of the diagnostic lab. And I would say that the college and the Board of Animal Health maintain a very strong collaboration, an excellent working relationship in the oversight of the Veterinary Diagnostic Lab. The sixth slide kind of illustrates how having a diagnostic lab within a veterinary college, within a research university, really works. So the diagnostic lab is at the forefront, recognizing problems as they emerge in the state, in our animal population. And at the same time, there are conduits to the researchers and basic scientists at the university and in the veterinary college that can solve these problems. So they provide this ideal conduit that can go back and forth, bringing problems to the researchers and taking solutions from the researchers to the field in an applied sense. And I would make this one point that all of the top diagnostic labs in the nation are located within a veterinary college. Any diagnostic lab that's not in a veterinary college is not a top-tier diagnostic lab. So I used on the eighth slide, I used our example of our response to the porcine epidemic diarrhea virus. I've been visiting with a number of you in your offices, so you've all heard me talk about PED virus. But it is a great example of how this was something that the diagnostic lab identified. Here's this new emerging disease. It's a problem. we need diagnostic tests so that our veterinarians and our producers can find out how to control this disease. And so that's what happened. The diagnostic lab worked with researchers. We developed new tests. They're the first validated tests that were available in the nation to help the swine industry. And 2 weeks ago when I was here, I talked to you about our veterinary isolation facility that is a bonding request. And again, I want to use this porcine epidemic diarrhea virus example. So once we had diagnosed the disease, once we figured out how to have tests that work, we still needed to understand how this disease got spread back and forth. And we need a safe facility where we can do those types of studies, where we can introduce the virus into a group of animals, study the spread of the disease without fear of spreading it into the swine population within our state. So this is a great example of how the diagnostic lab and this new veterinary isolation biocontainment facility will work hand in hand in us responding to disease problems. The next slide, I apologize, is actually a transition slide. So first you're going to see a bunch of pictures, and then you're going to see this word box pop up. But basically it just shows that the diagnostic lab was built in 1993. It's a good facility. We added on to it in 2008, expanding our postmortem capabilities. And it's a full-service lab. We can do all of the testing you'd expect, from bacterial testing to any type of pathologic testing. And I do want to point out that we're unique in that we have what's called an electron microscope. So not only can we look at the pathology lesions with our eyes, we can look at them through a regular microscope, and we can look at them through an electron microscope down at the small cellular detail, and I'll explain on this in a bit. The diagnostic lab, as is shown on slide 11, is part of many national disease networks. So it's part of the USDA network, the CDC network, the FDA network, and it's also part of the Minnesota Department of Health network. So it's connected in the disease reporting and surveillance function that Chair Hamilton mentioned earlier. So I hope, as slide 12 suggests, I hope I've convinced you that the diagnostic lab is an important resource within the state. I hope that you see its service functions are important, its education functions are important, and its research functions are important. In order to maintain and advance our diagnostic lab's leadership role, there are some equipment and facilities requests that we're proposing. And so on slide 13, it lays some of those out. First of all is getting back to this electron microscope. So with new emerging diseases, before we even have a test for them, the electron microscope is a really valuable tool because it allows it to actually see the agent. So you can actually see a viral particle within an infected piece of animal tissue. And so by identifying this virus, you can say, oh, this looks like this class of virus. Maybe it could be this related agent. And so there's a picture there of a pox virus, just for example. So it's a really important tool. The one we have is 30 years old. We are fortunate to have probably the best ultrastructural pathologist in the nation working at our diagnostic lab. And getting some upgraded equipment would be a great advance for our ability to diagnose new and emerging disease problems, not only for livestock, but when I was here 2 weeks ago, I mentioned a new virus of bees called bee paralysis virus. Well, we've also been able to visualize that with our electron microscope. In addition, our lab has grown considerably. We now do 1.5 million tests a year. And the lab receiving area that we designed over 20 years ago isn't big enough for all the samples that are coming into this lab. In addition, we need biosafety hoods for processing those samples so that we make sure that the sample security is good and there's no risk of cross-contamination between samples. I mentioned about training diagnostic pathologists. This is the hardest area within the veterinary profession to recruit and train people to work in. And so we're requesting some upgraded facilities to do that training, where we can have technology-rich training area where all of our students can see all of the images necessary from our teaching materials. And then finally, our molecular diagnostic laboratory is a source of pride for our lab. It's often the first test that we develop. These are the DNA tests that you see highlighted, for example, on these NCI shows. But in this case, we're not looking for human DNA. We're looking for the DNA and RNA of infectious agents. And so it's a very sensitive test. And we're looking for upgraded equipment to allow us to do faster screening of the DNA and RNA of organisms. We're looking for advanced bioinformatics equipment that will let us analyze these huge data sets that come out of these sequencer screeners. And then we're also looking for just robotic instruments to help us process all of these samples that are coming into our diagnostic lab. And then on page 14, the last thing that we're talking about is a really unique concept. And so we're talking about creating three sites within the state that would be postmortem facilities, and they would basically have technicians working in these postmortem facilities that would be virtually linked to the pathologist in the diagnostic lab. So these technicians would be carrying out postmortems under the direction of the pathologist in the diagnostic lab. They would be collecting samples according to the pathologist's directions and shipping those samples into the diagnostic lab. But it would provide the advantage that not every animal would have to be hauled all the way to the middle of St. Paul for a postmortem, and that these tests could be done with technicians at these sites and greatly expand the reach and effectiveness of our diagnostic labs. We've suggested three possible sites just as examples. Certainly there's been discussions with the poultry industry about doing something in Wilmer, either at the McBrock facility or at the Minnesota Poultry Testing Lab. But those would be examples of where we could be doing these technician-handled postmortems that are done by virtual hookup to pathologists in our diagnostic lab. It creates a really efficient, technology-rich way of doing this. And the last slide just kind of tells you that we're already doing this. We've been doing this in consultation with developing nations. We have a telepathology piece of equipment in our diagnostic lab. We're helping pathologists in Uganda. We're helping pathologists in China. We're already using this to beam images into our classrooms, so students can be in a classroom and can see something that's happening on the postmortem floor. And we actually do all of the pathology for the cancer center on the laboratory animals. And so our pathologists talk back and forth to the University of Minnesota's Cancer Center on the other campus. So it's not new. Human physicians and their pathologists have been using this to do frozen sections of cancer biopsies in rural hospitals, and then consult with the pathologist real time and tell the surgeon what's the best course of action. So we're just capitalizing on a technology that's already up and in use. And we would be the first state and the first diagnostic lab to use this technology to have expanded reach within our state. So again, I want to thank you for this opportunity to come and talk about the diagnostic lab. It's certainly a great source of pride for the college and for the university. I'd be happy to answer any questions. We do have the state veterinarian, Dr. Bill Hartman, here that can talk from the Board of Animal Health's perspective. And we also have the former state veterinarian, who now is with the Minnesota Veterinary Medical Association, Dr. Tom Haggerty, that can bring their perspective as well.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Ames. Would you like to have... Dr. Collins?
If you've got any questions, I can answer them.
Yeah.
I don't have, but it's okay. More important, I think, that we get Bill, you want to come up?
Dr. Hartman and...
Madam Chair, yes. If we can hear from the other two testifiers, that'd be great.
Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Haggerty, and I am representing the 2,500 member veterinarians of Minnesota with the Minnesota Board of Animal Health. The diagnostic lab is extremely important to the veterinarians of the state, but not only the veterinarians, but also to the livestock owners, to the animal owners, companion animal, equine, and those folks that need diagnosis need it quickly. And we depend very much on the diagnostic lab. We depend on their service, and the veterinarians use those services frequently. So they're very important to us. They've done very good work for us, but as things evolve, as new diseases show up, as the PED, the porcine epidemic, diarrhea virus, and others, and rabies, we're dealing with rabies continually. These diseases are so important that we have adequate diagnostic people and equipment available. And so we appreciate the work of the Diagnostic Lab of the College of Veterinary Medicine, and we strongly support the request for this fund. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Hagerty. Dr. Hartman, do you have...
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Bill Hartman. I'm the State Veterinarian and Executive Director of the Board of Animal Health. And I would just say that the Veterinary Diagnostic Lab is our official laboratory. So the board, unlike the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Health, we don't have our own laboratory. This laboratory at the University of Minnesota is what we rely on for our diagnostic capabilities, and it's crucial. When we had tuberculosis in northwestern Minnesota, you probably remember that. It was the Veterinary Diagnostic Lab where we sent the initial suspect animals to have postmortems done and to give us information about the disease. So it also is involved when we have a foreign animal disease investigation. So somebody reports something that looks like a disease that we don't have in this country, and they get that information to us. We send somebody out to the farm to investigate that, and the samples get sent now, which is new, to our veterinary diagnostic lab here in Minnesota, rather than Plum Island, New York, which takes quite a deal of time to get the samples to. We can get them done right here at our diagnostic lab. And Dr. Ames mentioned porcine epidemic diarrhea. If we didn't have the diagnostic capabilities that we have here and the ability to develop tests for the disease, we would be helpless. So this is an important diagnostic lab for us, and I read the things they're proposing, and I think they're excellent ideas to look into the future. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If there's any questions...
Members have any questions at all? Oh, Representative Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I have a couple questions. It seems to me like this might be a very good investment. I was interested in a couple of points that you were making in your presentation. One of them is the potential and actuality of animal-to-human contamination, transmission of various diseases. And you mentioned somewhere in here... initially looking at surveillance. What are we doing right now to keep track of that? Are we tracking that? Is it on a surveillance system when a animal disease has been transmitted to a human or vice versa? That's my first question.
Dr. Hagen.
Talk about that. So the Board of Animal Health, the Veterinary Diagnostic Lab, and the Minnesota Department of Health are all linked around these sorts of disease transmission or potential disease transmission episodes. And so I'll let Jim maybe answer that more specifically.
Yeah, Dr.
So
Collins?
There's a list of reportable diseases that is developed by the Board of Animal Health, and all of those diseases we're obligated to report to the Board of Animal Health. And Board of Animal Health is our first reporting. And then from the Board of Animal Health, if it involves a health issue, then it goes to the Department of Health through the Board of Animal Health. And if it's a wildlife issue, it goes then to the DNR. And if it's a food safety issue, then it goes to the Department of Agriculture. So we're all connected, and all the data is being tracked. And all not only is it being tracked, we're developing systems to track the animal movement and even the trucks and so forth, so that we can know where these pigs, because a pig in North Carolina is soon in southern Minnesota, and so we need to know what's going on in North Carolina also. So,
Representative Clark?
Madam Chair, well, one of the things I was thinking about is some things that may be transmitted to animals, or and maybe even starting in a plant. I was recently reading about a certain kind of exotic fungus that has really taken off. Maybe you're familiar with that, and it is something that is occurring in animals, and I don't know if it's being transmitted to humans, but it's something that we're not tracking very well. So do we have a system then? What, let's say the farmer or the farm worker comes down with a ailment that is related to something that an animal had or that they got through plant to animal to human.
Mm-hmm. We do.
Do we have
influenza, for instance, the transmission of influenza from people to animals and then back and forth. Yeah, we have those systems all in place, you know, between the Department of Health and the labs and the Board of Animal Health. And so, yeah, so influenza, we have facilities to work with highly pathogenic influenza, and we have the ability to detect it and share that information with if it concerns a human health issue, with the Department of Health and with the Board of Animal Health.
Thank you, Dr. Clark.
Just my last question. I'm wondering then, do we have it related to occupation?
Dr. Clark. Related, go ahead.
Related to occupation, because I know we don't track cancer by occupation, and there's a number of things we don't track by occupation, but do we track any of these things by occupation, particularly in the farm sector? That's my question.
Dr. Ames. Thank you.
Thank you. The University of Minnesota School of Public Health, the Minnesota Department of Health, and the College of Veterinary Medicine jointly are part of a what's a CDC NIOSH Occupational Safety Health Grant, and it's a center of excellence called UMASH, which stands for Upper Midwest Animal Safety something. I'm sorry, I can't pull that one right off the top of my head. And so they are actually tracking not only diseases that are affecting farm workers, they're also tracking, as you brought up, occupational injuries that are related to farm workers, and including veterinarians. And so this is something that is, Minnesota is one of six centers of excellence in the nation that is looking at this specific question that you raised.
Okay.
And I would just story. I think some of you may remember when there was concerns about neurologic disease affecting some of the pork plant workers in Austin, Minnesota. And so there was concern that possibly those individuals could be affected by a swine pathogen. And so our diagnostic lab actually worked with the Minnesota Department of Health to figure out how we could anonymize the information. And so for the first time in the history of the diagnostic lab, we ran human samples, 300 serum samples and 300, I think it might have been saliva samples, to determine, and were able to rule out that these pork plant workers did not have any of the known swine pathogens that could affect them. So it's another example of how, on occasion, when these things emerge, the agencies and the diagnostic lab could work together.
Thank you, Dr. Ames. Members, we just have 1 minute left, and I know Representative Lewick had a question, but we need to wrap this up. So,
actually, Madam Chair, not a question, just a comment that the diagnostic lab, from an emergency management standpoint, a lot of times we'll get into things that deal with both human and livestock issues from a health standpoint. It's important that we can get the answers quick, and with that type of a lab here in Minnesota, it's a huge thing. It supports the industry in general, because that's where the vets send the samples that they can't deal with at their local level. So this is a huge investment, both in the agriculture industry, but also in even human health, because there are those reportable diseases. Some of them can be very dangerous to human beings also. So we need to keep that place working good and keep it close. It's really pretty basic stuff.
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And we bring this before all of you in order to stay competitive, cement the status as a national leader, and address strategic initiatives. And most importantly, if not to make sure that we effectively serve the VDL stakeholders. So with that, I renew my motion to have this be held over for possible inclusion.
Thank you. Well, with that, members, I believe it's time to adjourn. Thank you.
Hold it over.
Oh. Right. What did you say? You said it's held over. Oh, sorry. We'll move that the bill will be laid over. Sorry. And with that, we'll adjourn.